So there's a number of challenges that we see consistently at both a local and global level with health and well-being. We've got a multi-generational and increasingly diverse workforce, which creates an increasing need for diversity and demand for diversity of benefits and support. We also see in the younger generation an increase in the importance of values and social contribution within the job roles, and that's increasingly important to them in remaining with the company. Demographically, we've got an aging workforce. We're working longer and more likely to be changing careers. There's high potential social costs in many countries, and many people are now happier to change careers. So if they're not comfortable with their role at the company, they're much happier to move than they were perhaps 20 or 30 years ago. There's a number of health risks. We've all heard of the diabetes, time bombs, and all those sorts of things that are expected to go off. And actually, longevity is now reducing slightly and is expected to forecast is it will continue to reduce a little bit. Interestingly, a report just a couple of weeks ago from Blue Cross in America, 54 million or something like that, insured members in the US, and it demonstrated that past the age of 27, the health of millennials was actually worse on the 10 key traits than Generation X. So again, increased mental health problems, increase in diabetes, etc., which was a bit of a shock. Socially, there's a shift because of the cost and aging population. Particularly, there is a shift of responsibility from the state. They're trying to move it onto individuals, and obviously companies are picking up some of that. So particularly around pensions, we've seen that, and medical, etc. And with the always-on digital culture, that brings health challenges, but also expectations around how we will engage as an employer, as a company, how you will engage with your employees and communicate with them. And there's increased expectations about the support and flexibility. So again, it's no longer work-life balance, it's more about work-life integration. Personal tasks will be undertaken during work hours and at work and vice versa. And that sort of blend that people were trying to avoid and separate for so many years is actually sort of reversing. So if you look at some of the trends that we're seeing, the progressive companies realised some time ago that health and well-being can be directly contribute to other business goals, particularly around diversity and inclusion and GPG. So we're seeing a lot more focus on directing specific health and well-being programmes to other business goals. As health and well-being has matured, so there's a need for increased governance to measure return on investment and outcomes. On a global level, health and well-being, companies want to roll that out rather than just the fully sort of developed, financially mature countries. And of course, we've got the impact of telemedicine, behavioral science, artificial intelligence, intelligent automation, etc. And there's more of a collaborative approach between governments and companies, charities, etc. So talking of diversity and inclusion, there's a number of key points there because there's a lot of similarities between them. Basically, they both respect human differences and support the conditions rather than seeing them as weaknesses. That's the view on it. And so diversity, inclusion, health and well-being really sit very closely together with a lot of synergies. If we look at gender pay gap just as one example, it may seem like common sense, but it's far from common practice. It's important to ensure that all of the components are synergistic, that they support each other rather than challenge or provide obstacles. And I often see that they do conflict or undermine each other. So if you look at that, for examples, the female-specific health risks, endometriosis is one I'm glad to see getting some press just in the last couple of months. In the UK, there's a 7.5-year average diagnosis period. For a chronic condition that creates an immense amount of pain, that's just dreadful. And it affects 1 in 10 women. So there's various studies, but one of them in Europe, a fairly significant study, suggested that it was as high as 11 hours of the working week, which is in lost productivity through endometriosis. It really is a terrible condition. Menopause, of course, affects 50% of the population. But equally also affects the partners. And when we did some work with one client that had a very high female population, a particular age range, of course menopause was high on the radar when they did surveys. But what they surprised was the number of responses from men in the firm because they were being affected by menopause through their wives and partners. So the question, of course, is, how does your medical plan, how does your disability plan, how do your company policies and things deal with these aspects, because they all manage them differently. Do you have care pathways that support them, for example? Then in terms of the social risks, we've got things like the sandwich generation. 58% of working carers in the UK are going to be female, and more and more likely to be looking after not just a younger child, but also possibly a dependent adult relative. So, what about that's going to further increase by 2030, and also brings increase in things like musculoskeletal injuries, etc., as well as financial pressures and stress. So again, what about emergency elder care, childcare? What about your support policies, flexible working policies? Are they proactive? And it's the same with postnatal depression. There's many, many different areas within the social side that I could talk about. But postnatal depression affecting between 10 and 20% of women in the first year following the birth of a child. Even things like male paternity pay can have a positive impact on that. So there's lots and lots of things to consider. So increasingly what we, the sort of work that we're doing demonstrates that it's worth looking at the demographics of your actual workforce to identify the risks within that are key. Looking at your company policies and making sure that they're aligned. Most companies will have flexible working policy, but as I say, for example, is it proactive? There's a big difference between, you can have flexible working policies that almost suggest that they should take it. They're very proactive as opposed to just kind of being hurdles that you've got to go through, and the expectation is it wouldn't really be accepted. Similarly, looking at your benefits themselves, how do they align? They all treat these conditions differently, and are they aligned with your care pathways and your HR processes? So moving on to formalising the strategies and looking at your roadmaps going forward, that was one of the key things that came out in the poll. The first thing is the data strategy. I tend to find historically health and wellbeing programmes have developed the wrong way around. They've developed from the bottom of this scale up and not top down. So data strategy is critical. It provides the evidence of what you need to do, why you need to do it, and where you need to point it. And so metrics are essential to ensure that you can measure return on investment in future, that you can measure the effectiveness of things, because I've seen interventions, as we'll see, as we'll talk through in a moment, that have actually had a negative impact on productivity. So you need to continue to measure what's working for you. Then we move on to the branding and pillars. In the same way, a branding can be globally consistent, or it could, and it can be also be local, but the branding is unique to your organisation. It should be, it's how you communicate, it's how you market the health and wellbeing programme, and it really is a big differentiator. A good brand for wellbeing programme will align with the company products, the company values, and the company brand, and be instantly recognised by employees, but equally by the local community as well. It should be your unique fingerprint. Within that, you'll have the pillars, and it may also have strategic lenses for on the go sort of testing and quick testing of things. But ultimately, it drives engagement, it drives the communication effectiveness. And then underneath that, we have the frameworks. It is very, very important to formalise your frameworks, particularly around things like mental health. If you do not have the correct infrastructure in place, and if you're not coming at it from the right angles, sort of 360-degree view, then you can actually make the situation worse. And I see this all the time. With the best intention, bringing in, for example, mental health awareness training without support networks behind it will create stress amongst managers who don't know what to do, HR that don't have a pathway to follow, and an increase in self-diagnosis and therefore more claims on policies, perhaps more sickness absence, etc. So you need a framework, and increasingly those are being formally drafted. This ensures that you have positive incomes. So in other words, it's the how, the when, and the why. And then finally, underneath that, we have the actual initiatives, interventions, and campaigns. And as I say, typically what I see is companies start with these. It's the doing, and it's very easy to fall into that trap. But you need the structure behind it if you're going to guarantee success. So we just talk about a case study that sort of demonstrates a few of these points. This particular company was already doing a considerable amount of initiatives around health and wellbeing, particularly in the psychological health aspect. But there was huge gaps in their data, and they lacked a formal approach. From the data they did have and the sickness absence management, it seemed that productivity was reducing, and there seemed to be an increase in stress-related absence, but they couldn't put a finger on the reasons why. Being a global company, and the UK was used as a pilot for the EMEA region, so they wanted to roll out from the UK and Europe into other entities. But basically, because they couldn't measure, demonstrate the return on investment, nor could they actually pinpoint the cause of the stress-related absence increase, the board refused to offer any more funding. So we basically looked at the data strategy, first of all, and recognised that there was a number of gaps. As very commonly happens, they tend to focus on the physical, mental through benefit plans. But benefit plan data was only covering a relatively small population of a subset of the workforce. Many of the shop floor, et cetera, did not have access to those plans. So the first thing was to introduce a kiosk program to actually gather some health risk data. Then we revised the occupational health procedures and tools, and actually we found that bonus policy, one of the elements of bonus policy, was causing the stress-related absence. Was actually also increasing absence because of the way that it worked. And so we also reviewed the sickness reporting and procedures as well and developed a dashboard with those two things in combination. Finally, a mental health framework was drafted and there was a three-year roadmap put in place to feed into their branding and pillars. The outcome, immediately, because we did this in a very sort of partnership fashion, we had focus groups and workshops to gather, to sort of feedback on the data that we gathered, and also to develop the frameworks. We saw an immediate uplift in employee engagement, and that was done through, there was a number of apps and tools that actually using the UTREC scale, but through some apps, employees were tested and reported every day, just one or two questions. And what we saw was an immediate spike, and this was because the focus team were immediately reporting back, and that focus team was made up of representatives of the managers, but there's also shop floor people, etc. And they were reporting back that this thing was going to change. And so we saw a spike in engagement. Over a little bit of time, as things were developed, that dropped off again. And then when the changes were introduced, it rose back. And then it sort of plateaued and stayed there. So that was really positive. The data strategies allowed them to monitor and review on an ongoing basis. And obviously, because of the mental health framework, they have now, 18 months later, seen a significant reduction in psychological-related illness. And because we were able to pinpoint the KPI within the benefit plan, the bonus plan, that's been removed, changed, and actually it's created a cost saving, but also has reduced the sickness absence. Subsequently, because they were able to actually measure the return on investment and demonstrate this to the board, so additional funding was granted to roll out that pilot and framework into other countries, and they are now further expanding out into Asia.